Well, it's a pleasure to be here in New York and to have this chance to speak to you about the carcinogenic effects of radiation. And I guess I would start out by saying that since Erica spoke about the acute effects, which one generally thinks about when thinking about radiation, but I think in general if there's a terrorism act, most of the people are going to have relatively low doses of exposure, and therefore, as he mentioned, acute effects won't be the most important health effect, whereas the carcinogenic effects are more likely to occur over a long period of time and over a wide distribution of doses. So epidemiology, for those who don't know what it is the study of the distribution and determinants of disease in human populations. And very differently from other aspects of the medical sciences, in this case, then you're talking about large groups of people rather than individual patients. And the studies are conducted in humans, and they have real exposures. But, of course, this causes certain problems because, unlike exposures with mice, you can't put them in the cage, give them something to eat or be exposed to, and then follow them up. You're really dependent on working with humans who never do what you really think they're going to do or can expect to do, and therefore you don't have as clear-cut results as when you're doing animal experiments. So as I said, these studies are observational rather than, experimental, and you have all the possibilities of confounding and bias. And so just in terms of radiation exposure, when you are studying people who have radiation exposure, if just as an example they were treated with radiation, they have a disease which could be confounding, they could have had other types of treatment which could be confounding. Or if you're thinking about, for instance, the atomic bomb survivors, they are exposed to radiation, but they were also exposed to many other conditions at the time of the bomb. You also have a great deal of uncertainties in terms of the dose estimation. You don't always know what kind of doses people had. I think that in radiation epidemiology, we're doing better than in other areas of epidemiology because sometimes people are badged if it's an occupational exposure, and with medical exposures, often you have the medical records. There's also in epidemiology a problem of multiple comparisons. You very often are looking at many different outcomes, and therefore you run into certain kinds of statistical problems. And when you're either using small populations or low doses, you have the problems of statistical power, which can limit your abilities to detect health effects. But the main types of epidemiological studies are clinical trials, cohort studies, case control studies, and ecological studies, and I have presented them that way sort of in the order of how good they are. Clinical trials are certainly the best kind of study you can do because, again, you're randomizing groups, and you certainly have a little bit more control than when you're just observing people in studies such as the design with cohort and case control studies. But the worst kind is an ecological study because there you're dealing with groups of people where you don't have individual information on these groups. So any kind of epidemiologic study, when you're reading the literature or when you're planning one yourself, but mostly I guess most of the people in this room will be reading the literature, you have to keep in mind many of the methodological issues. And one is that you have the appropriate study population for the endpoint that you want to look at, that you do have the adequate statistical power, and that very often is difficult. Charles Land once tried to measure what the study population would have to be to look at one rad of exposure in people, and basically you would need close to 1 million people. So that's a bit of a problem when you want to look at any kind of low-dose exposures. You have to have reliable dose estimates, which can either be reconstructed when you're talking about environmental exposures or can be measured when you're using badges. And you have to have good outcome information. So in other words, you really have to be certain that when you're talking about a cancer, that it really is a cancer and not some other kind of disease. And as I mentioned, you need to know about confounders and other risk modifiers. So radiation epidemiology, of course, is a subspecialty of epidemiology, and the main purpose of it is to characterize and quantify the risk of cancer in populations exposed to radiation alone or in combination with other agents or risk factors. And the reason that we want to study radiation, I think, is one, it's very important to have human data when you're trying to recommend or regulate protection standards, both for workers and for the general public. There really are no guidelines for medical use of radiation, but there are both international and national guidelines for workers and the general public. Radiation epidemiology results have been very useful in terms of modifying some of radiotherapy, also for better understanding individual susceptibility, and I think some of the earlier talks mentioned these points about individual susceptibility, and just to learn more about carcinogenesis in general. So just to give you a little bit of history, you probably know that X-rays were discovered in 1895, and very shortly after that, like within a year, they were first used medically to treat a nevus, and then a year after that, actually, to treat cancer. And it was one of the first human carcinogens to be discovered, not the first, but one of them. It's also probably, after smoking, the best studied environmental carcinogen. And by 1905, it was realized that radiation can cause skin cancer in radiologists or people who were working with radiation experimentally. And over the whole the 1900s, we kept learning more and more about radiation. And in the last, I'd say, few decades, sort of occupational exposure has declined and medical exposure has increased as we're using more diagnostic radiation and even more radiotherapy. So you might have heard about this, but in the 1920s, young women were employed using radium to paint the dial of watches so that you could see them at night. And these women, mostly in Chicago, were then found to have an excess of bone cancer. About 20 years later, studies of radiologists both in the U.S. and in the U.K. were undertaken, and they found that radiologists had increased risks of leukemia. And then in the early 1950s, the first cancer that was seen in excess in the ABOM survivors was leukemia. Followed fairly soon after that, they found an excess of thyroid cancer. By the 1960s, they already realized that lung cancer was caused from exposure to radon in the mines. And since then, people have been learning more and more about individual cancers that can be caused by radiation, at what doses, and other kind of risk modifiers. So the main, probably the only types of exposure are medical, environmental, occupational, and then military. And I'm going to talk about some individual studies, just to sort of use them to make some points about radiation and carcinogenesis. So I heard earlier today that the ABOM survivor studies were mentioned, and this is sort of considered the gold standard of radiation studies. It's I'm going to talk a lot about it later on, but basically the atomic bomb survivor studies are based on a large cohort of survivors in Hiroshima and Nagasaki that have been followed up since the 1950s and continually followed by the Radiation Effects Foundation in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There are studies of medical exposure, both diagnostic and radiotherapy. And for environmental exposures, that people have been studied who have residential radon, radiation accidents, of course, like Chernobyl, and also in Guyana in Brazil, there was a radiation accident where somebody took a radiation source from a hospital, not knowing what it was, wanted to sell it for scrap metal, I believe, and many thousands of people were exposed. There have been several studies of people exposed to fallout from nuclear testing, both in the U.S. and the South Pacific. Emissions from nuclear plants, just studies of people who live near nuclear plants, and also, as I mentioned, obviously Chernobyl, and also in the former Soviet Union, where radiation has been dumped into rivers and other areas near there, and so general populations have been exposed. And then there are areas in the world, particularly in India and China, that have very high background rates of radiation. In terms of occupational exposure, the people that were mostly studied in the past were miners, hard ore miners, which would include uranium and tin and iron ore, and nuclear workers. But in fact, actually, there are more medical workers now than any other kind of radiation workers. And actually, in Europe, airline crew are considered radiation workers, but we don't consider them that in the U.S. So mostly we know about cancer risks from the atomic bomb survivors who were exposed to a single dose or an acute exposure up until recently. Now we have been learning more and more from medical exposures, and in particular from fractionated high dose or sometimes lower dose when you're talking about diagnostic exposures, but a lot from radiotherapy. But the public is really more concerned about these low-dose protracted exposures over time. And therefore, we have been putting more effort into trying to understand more about these low-dose and low-dose rate exposures. So just to give you some sense of what kind of doses we're talking about, so radiotherapy, there's a very wide range of doses, and this is specifically to a particular organ, trying to do it as closely as possible to the tumor site. But for cancer, such as prostate cancer, they can be actually as much as 80 gray. As Eric talked about when he was talking about acute exposures, the 50% survival probability is around 4 sievert or 4 gray. The mean dose for the atomic bomb survivors is 0.25. So, in fact, it's really not a very high dose study. The occupational limit is about 0.02 per year. And in a large study of nuclear workers, they actually receive much, much less than that because exposures, occupational exposures have been decreasing quite a bit over time as we use better methods to protect workers. And the background radiation could be anywhere between 0.002 and 0.004, mostly depending on how much radon there is in a specific area. For diagnostic medical tests, of course, there's a very, very wide range. And at the very higher range are CT scans. And just to get a sense, a round-trip flight from New York to London would be about 0.0001, and that's mostly cosmic radiation. And that is the reason why, as I say, in Europe, airline crew are considered radiation workers. So to describe radiation risks, we use some measures of risk that are slightly different than many other epidemiologic studies, partially or mainly because we can quantify risks better with radiation than for most other exposures. So, for instance, when people are talking about oral contraceptives exposures, they usually can talk about the number of pills, whereas in radiation we can actually usually talk about a dose. Most other radiation actually can only talk about exposure. They certainly can't talk about what the exposure is to a specific organ, except for in a very few situations with chemicals. So an excess relative risk is the percentage change in risk for a unit dose, and in this case, generally, it's gray, once in a while, sievert. And I think that an excess relative risk is best in terms of thinking about etiology. It helps you try and understand what a cause of disease is. The excess absolute risk, on the other hand, is sort of a rate difference, and it gives you actually a number. And so it's very, very important in terms of public health and planning. So you would want to know the number of people who have an excess radiation-related cancer, whereas in the relative risk, you would know what the percent increase is. So both of these are very important, and they would vary by other modifying factors such as age, time, gender, what other kind of risk factors they were exposed to, but they do provide slightly different information. So the first study that I am going to talk about, because that we do have the most information from it, is from the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, the Lifespan Study. And I'm going to give you results. They will be published actually in July on this second solid cancer incidence report, which is follow-up from 1958 through 1998. The bomb, as you know, bombs fell in 1945, so there's actually more than 50 years of follow-up, which is a great deal of time. And it's a large study, so we've been able to learn a lot about it. This shows Hiroshima the way it looks today. It's actually a very lovely city right now. You can see RERF, which is a binational foundation. It's run by the National Academy of Sciences on the U.S. side and actually the Ministry of Health on the Japanese side. And it's actually a bunch of old Quonset huts that were built during the Second World War. And so these are data from the Radiation Effects Research Foundation. So the objectives of the incidence report is to quantify the cancer risks attributable to radiation. That's the most important. And explore the shape of the dose response. And these data really are the ones that are used most in terms of setting standards for radiation exposure. They're generally enhanced by information from the medical and occupational exposures, but they are the mainstay for radiation protection. Assess how the risk is modified by age, time, gender, and other factors. Help clarify site-specific differences and risk patterns, and I think that this is important because not all cancers are the same and not all organs are the same. And there are quite a few differences in terms of the biology of the organs and therefore what the risk factors are. Unfortunately, when I get to talk about individual sites, it's very hard to find actual statistically significant differences because the numbers aren't large enough. And then I'll just highlight some issues about cancer sites that maybe need further research. So the LSS cohort includes a group of people who are within 2.5 kilometers of the bombings, and then they try to sort of match them in terms of age and gender with a group of people who were exposed, who were living or were in within 2.5 and 10 kilometers, and then a group of city who were actually originally Hiroshima residents or Nagasaki, but were not in either city at the time of the bomb, but had returned by 1950 and were there when they did the census. So altogether, there are 120,000 people in this cohort. When you start doing analysis for the actual study, and we take out the people who do not have doses. 95% of the cohort have doses, but about 6,000 people don't. And then if you're looking at cancer incidence, one of the main problems is that the cancer registries were set up in Hiroshima and Nagasaki only in 1958, and so the people had to be alive and not known to have cancer at that time. Unfortunately, that also means you can't really look at latency period very well because you don't have information on the first 13 years. So included in this analysis are the 105,000 people, and as you can see, there were about 17,500 first primary tumors that were analyzed. And only first primary tumors were included because if one included second cancers, you wouldn't be able to distinguish the radiation from the A-bomb and the radiotherapy that was given as treatment for the first cancers. And in addition, people who have a first cancer are generally watched much carefully medically, and therefore there's a higher detection rate. So one of the strengths of the LSS cohort compared to other studies is that it's a very large, healthy, non-selected population, and it includes people of all ages and both sexes. And indeed, there are about 35,000 people who were exposed to radiation before the age of 20, which makes it, I think, the largest study of childhood exposure. There's a wide range of doses, including people who had no radiation, up to 4 gray, and very good mortality follow-up. As I mentioned, the cancer incidence, however, is based on the registries, and therefore it's only for people living in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So there is no follow-up for 1945 to 1958 in terms of solid cancers. There was some data from leukemia when our leukemia registry was set up earlier, so there's data from 1950 for leukemia. And there unfortunately isn't very much treatment information. So this shows the cohort of 105,000 people by dose. And as you can see, these are the group, as I mentioned, who were not in the city at the time, about 25,000 people. And what is really interesting, even though people think of this as a high-dose study, it really isn't. There are a large number of people who had between 0.005 and 0.1 gray, which are considered low doses. In fact, over 1 gray, you have only about 3%. Less than 3% of the study cohort. Although I have to say that the people who had over 1 gray do help provide a lot of the information about the carcinogenesis. Just to get a sense, of the cancers that occurred, Japan has different types of cancers than we have in the U.S. In certain areas. For instance, the digestive system is largely stomach cancer, and about a third of the cancers in this cohort are stomach cancers. On the other hand, they have much less breast cancer than we have in this country, although that's changing over time, and stomach cancer is decreasing, breast cancer is increasing, and this change in cancer incidence trends actually affects how you have to do the analysis of radiation risks. I think this shows the number of observed cancers by dose, the number of excess cancers, and then the attributable risk. And so it shows that for people who had at least 0.005 gray, 11% practically of the cancers were due to their radiation. If you take the entire cohort, including the not in city and the ones that had really very, very low doses, it goes down to about 5%. But this, I think, shows that while radiation certainly causes cancer, it's not the strongest carcinogen. Asbestos, for instance, would be a much stronger carcinogen than radiation. And part of the reason is that radiation is very good at killing cells, so that at very high doses, for instance, many of the cells are killed, and therefore they really can't transform and become cancers. Well, I think that this is one of the most important of the slides, because it shows that there really is pretty much of a linear dose response for all solid cancers. And there really is no evidence of a threshold in the A-bomb survivor data. And I believe it was Eric who mentioned earlier that this is a big question. What is the response at low doses? The A-bomb survivor data show that even at very low doses, you do have a risk for excess cancers. And the best thing, at least in terms of any kind of public health advice or setting standards for exposure, is to assume that there is a linear dose response. Well, in this slide, you can see both the effects of age at exposure. This is when I mentioned the excess relative risk, and this is the excess absolute risk. And you can see that with age at exposure, the risks are higher as the age of exposure goes down, and they continue, though, throughout time. Here's the attained age. But they decrease until approximately age 40 plus, where then they seem to be more or less the same over time. Whereas if you're looking at the excess absolute risk, which is very important, then it shows why you see risk persisting throughout life, even though the risks are higher at younger age at exposure, but they continue throughout time. So that's why we still see 50 years after exposure an increased risk of all solid cancers combined in the atomic bomb survivors. This shows, using the excess relative risk versus the excess absolute risk, that females have a higher risk than males. It's about 50% higher, depending on which measure of risk you're using. When you exclude the sex-specific cancers, then pretty much of this disappears. So the site-specific cancer information, I think, is very important, and probably there are differences, but the variability that you do see is because the numbers are relatively small when you're talking about individual cancers. In general, they're not statistically significantly different, and it's possible that some of them are random. I'll try and point out the ones where they seem to be, one, statistically significantly different, and two, to make biological sense that they're different. So actually, over time, we're seeing some difference in the risk, the risks of the different sites. In the past, breast cancer actually had the highest risk, and now it's bladder cancer. Bladder cancer definitely occurs at older ages, and I think that as we have longer and longer follow-up, the risk for bladder cancer is going to increase. And at the moment, it has the highest risk of any of the cancer sites. This doesn't really give you, though, a good picture, because this is just an average. It's an average of both sexes. It's an average at all ages at exposure and all attained age. And all of that does have an effect. So this shows you what happens when you're looking at two different ages at exposure. And in this new report, it's the first time that we found that there really is an increased risk for people who are very young at exposure for developing cancer of the uterus. In the past, we weren't able to see that. And it all has to do with getting larger numbers. And these people also becoming to the age where they can develop cancer of the uterus. And so you can see for bladder cancer, there's not very much of a difference by age at exposure. For thyroid cancer, there's a huge difference between people who were young at exposure and people who were older at exposure, and it's actually the most extreme difference. Lung cancer is one of the few cancers where you see that older age exposure confers a higher risk, and this has to do with the smoking effects in Japan and actually the secular trends for smoking. When you take smoking into account, when you can actually look at the confounding by smoking, this difference pretty much goes away. And luckily, there are questionnaire data for a subset of the atomic bomb survivors so that one can look at smoking. And with those special analyses, the difference in age at exposure pretty much disappears. This shows the differences for males and females. Again, a lot of the difference here is actually due to smoking. So the two sites with the largest risks for females compared to males, bladder and lung, those are both highly related to smoking. And again, when you take into account smoking, these differences don't completely disappear, but they certainly are diminished. So in summary for the ABOM survivors, I want to say that the linear dose response, I think, is very clear. There's an increased risk, even at the very low doses of approximately 100 millisievert. Women have a higher risk overall, but when you take away the sex-specific cancers, that disappears. And the risk definitely is still continuing 50 years after exposure. And then we see different time and age effects depending on what kind of statistical model you're using.
Excuse me. before you leave the ABOM data, do you know if it's neutron dose, gamma dose, or what it could be?
Yeah, there's actually not very much neutron dose. There has been a new dosimetry. It's called DSO2, which was what was used in these analyses, where it turned out that actually the neutron dose was smaller than they had actually thought. With this new dosimetry, it decreases the risk very slightly, but most of the dose is gamma. But in the dosimetry system, you sum the gamma and the neutron, but the neutron is multiplied by 10. So the age-time patterns don't differ that substantially for the individual sites when you actually compare them. And this has become now an interesting statistical question, and several statisticians are trying to figure out a better way to compare differences in sites and cancer sites so that we might really be able to determine whether the patterns differ or not. I think that the overall patterns from this analysis are not that different from before, but as I pointed out, we have found new sites that are related to radiation, such as uterine cancer in young people. For the first time, we also found a dose response for male breast cancer based on very, very small numbers. And we are still finding new inferences in terms of time and age. So I think it's very important to continue the follow-up of the ABOM survivors because, in fact, of the 35,000 people who are under age 20, 85% of those people are still alive today. So for medical radiation, of course, this is a very important tool, but it's also a carcinogen, and therefore I think it has to be weighed very carefully when using radiation. There have been hundreds of studies of radiation used in medicine. The big advantage of these studies is that you generally can have fairly good dosimetry, at least in the radiotherapy studies. And there's a broad range of doses. And one of the big things that are different, though, between the medical studies and the ABOM survivors is that the ABOM survivors had whole body doses, whereas in the medical studies, it's usually to a specific organ with scatter to other organs, but overall it's to an organ, and so you can have much higher doses. And that also these studies actually can have impact on radiotherapy. So diagnostic radiation has increased dramatically in the U.S. Mostly, I think it is due to the CT, the use of CT scans, and CT scans generally have higher doses. So, in fact, the effective dose to patients in the U.S. has increased quite a bit between 1980 and 2000. To study patients, we usually use different types of phantoms to figure out the organ dose to the patients. Mostly, we used to use anthropomorphic phantoms. Today, I think it's much more modeling and mathematical phantoms and based on older data from the anthropomorphic ones. Let me just skip this one. But you can, from this slide, by the way, these are old data, but you can see that there were in the 1990s, about 250,000 medical x-rays per year. More recently, I've been told that it's more like 350,000, which would be almost like one per person per year. We don't have very good data from the U.S., however. So just to give, I'm going to give just a few examples of studies of diagnostic and then therapeutic. One of the studies that is very interesting in terms of diagnostic radiation is a study of scoliosis patients and breast cancer because these patients received multiple x-rays to monitor their scoliosis. And in a cohort study of about 5,000 people, young women actually, at the time when they received all of these x-rays, they've been followed up now for many years, and they found an increased risk of breast cancer. The excess relative risk is actually consistent with what is seen in the ABOM survivors. And this is at relatively low dose, 0.1 one gray, and it was protracted over many years. So it sort of suggests that maybe there is not a very big difference between protracted exposure to the breast and acute exposure. There have been pooled analyses, including many different types of radiation exposure to the breast, the A-bump survivors in medical populations, and they have found a similar, they have a similar finding where the protracted exposure doesn't differ very much from the acute exposure. Radiation treatment for benign diseases in the 1930s through the 1960s, this was actually fairly common. It has really decreased dramatically now, and it's used very little except for maybe I-131 for hyperthyroidism. But so we can't really learn much about new treatments, but from the treatments that occurred in the past, we can learn about radiation effects. And I'm just showing this slide, which is when radiation was used to treat peptic ulcer at very high doses, just to show that even when you're talking about doses of like 15 gray, the excess relative risk to the stomach is consistent with what you see for the A-bomb survivors. So even though at very high doses where people think that there's a lot of cell killing, there probably is some. The dose does appear to sort of stabilize. It doesn't keep going up forever, but it's still not that different from what you see with the A-bomb survivors. Somebody mentioned this morning, cancer has been the main effect that has been studied, but I just wanted to point out that both in the A-bomb survivors and in some of the medical studies, we're now seeing increased risks of coronary heart disease with dose responses, but we don't actually really know, have very much information yet on what the dose response actually is. That's obviously going to be the new area of research. So second cancers is of particular interest, I think, because people are surviving much longer now following their radiation treatment. And in the last year or two, out of the cancers reported to the SEER program at the NCI, approximately 13% are second cancers. So this is getting to be a bigger and bigger problem. And I'm just going to show you the results from one study, and this is of children, childhood cancers. Childhood cancer now has extremely high survival, and people are living a long time, and therefore there is a concern about their developing second cancers as well as other long-term health effects. And there is a large study of childhood cancers, 14,000 childhood cancers from 25 different centers in the U.S., and they've been doing periodic follow-ups. One of the recent ones was in terms of thyroid cancer. And they also have found that there's a very large risk for developing thyroid cancer after treatment with radiation, mostly for Hodgkin's disease, and that the risk increases with dose up to about 20 to 30 gray. And then again, it begins to flatten out. But it was close to linear up to about 30 gray. So occupational exposure is one of the big problems with studying them is that the doses are very low, and therefore you need huge numbers of people to study them. But there have been studies, pooled analyses of radiation workers, nuclear workers, and there's been one study that included about 400,000 people, which is the number you sort of need to actually come up with statistically significant findings. And in this particular study, as you can see, there is a statistically significant increased risk for solid cancers, which is, again, somewhat consistent. It's a little bit higher, but consistent with the A-bomb survivors. There's also an increased risk of leukemia, excluding CLL, but it's not statistically significant. In general, most studies have shown that CLL is not related to radiation exposure, but I think we still need a little bit more information on that because we can't learn anything about it from the A-bomb survivors since CLL hardly exists in Japan. Medical radiation workers are a group that are of particular interest now because the number of workers is growing all the time. It, as I say, it's now the largest occupational group. But we don't have good doses for these people because they didn't wear badges in the early years. We at NCI have a large study of technologists, and we're in the process of trying to reconstruct doses for them right now. Hopefully we'll have them very shortly. But I just wanted to show you that you can see for those people who began working in the early years when doses were probably quite high, you do see this trend for the for an increasing risk in the early years, which decreases over time as the protection standards got better and better and their doses got smaller and smaller. Environmental exposures are one that I think people are the most concerned about because they generally don't expect to be exposed and are exposed against their will. But in general, we don't have very good doses for these exposures. They're very low. They're very difficult to study, except for maybe radon, where huge populations have been exposed to it. So just give you a little information on residential radon, which is a concern, especially, I believe, in New Jersey, for people. And this is a study that was done in China where people live in caves. They're cave dwellings. They actually look like houses inside. But the people had large exposures to radon, and they didn't move around very much the way they do in this country, so you could actually estimate a dose. And when they compared the risks from that study and to the uranium miners, they actually found that they fit on the same line. I mean, there's a large confidence interval, but they all fit on the same line. And so that it does look like that even at the low doses that you get from residential exposure, you still see the increased risks of lung cancer. In this slide, you can actually see that there's an interaction between smoking and radon, which I think is rather important. So for smokers, radon causes certainly a fair number of lung cancers, but among the non-smokers, it's a considerably larger percentage. Quickly mention a few things about the Chernobyl accident. It is the worst accident in nuclear history. The main exposure was I-131. And since I-131 concentrates in the thyroid gland, that's where we're seeing the major effects. And because the dose is inversely proportional to the thyroid mass, children receive the highest doses, and also because they drink milk, and they got a lot of exposure from the milk because the cows ate the contaminated grass. So most of the effects that you are seeing really are in children. Oh, people, but they're no longer children because this was 20 years ago, but they were children when they were exposed. And you can see here that this is just the number of thyroid cancers and how they increase dramatically in Belarus and the Ukraine, particularly Belarus, where the doses were actually higher. Even though the accident was in the Ukraine, the winds brought more of the dose to Belarus. So there is a cohort study of about 25,000 people, two arms, Ukraine and Belarus. And the unique thing about this study is that there were actually measurements to the thyroid taken within 6 weeks after the accident. So far, there are only results from the Ukraine. And as you can see, there is a linear dose response. And this linear dose response is actually not very different from what is seen with external radiation exposure. So where the excess relative risk for a pooled analysis of external exposure was 7.7, when looking at the cohort study in the Ukraine, it's 5.2. And the case control study, these are the two analytic studies, the two best type of epidemiologic studies, it was 4.5. So even though there has been a lot of discussion in the past whether I-131 was as carcinogenic as external radiation, at least the data that we have to date from Chernobyl suggests that there's not a statistically significant difference. In terms of, there have also been studies of adults, and it's not, they haven't been statistically significant results, and studies of workers also have not shown statistically significant results except for possibly with leukemia. And there are more studies going on right now in terms of the workers who were doing the cleanup work in Chernobyl in terms of leukemia. So probably last thing is to talk, there are some new cohorts that I think will be adding a lot of information about radiation effects. People who were exposed to the nuclear testing in Kazakhstan, three different cohorts of people who were exposed to radiation due to the Mayak nuclear facility in the former Soviet Union, the nuclear workers, people living near the Tetra River, and the population of the people living right near the nuclear facility who were exposed to I-131 that was sort of spewed out from the stacks, airline crew, and then I think patients who are treated with new technologies. So the overall conclusions, I think, are that most cancers can be induced by radiation. There are very few cancers that we can clearly say are not related to radiation. Young age at exposure appears to increase risk. The risk does continue throughout life. There's really very little evidence, I would say none, to suggest a threshold. And for solid cancer, at least, we have pretty definite and direct evidence of a linear dose response. And at extremely high doses, when you're talking about radiotherapy and tens of gray to a specific organ, there does seem to be some flattening out due to cell killing. And the questions, I think, that remain, and in this case, we'll certainly need to work as multidisciplinary teams, I think, to answer many of them, is exactly how much cancer is caused by radiation. People have always thought it's about 5%, but that's really not that clear. How long does the risk last? It appears to be lifetime, but we don't know about the people who are very young at exposure. How is radiation caused? Is there really great differences in radiation sensitivity for organs and tissues? We know very little about the radiation sensitivity of individuals, and we have to learn more about interactions between radiation and other factors, particularly with radiotherapy and chemotherapy. So.